Yes, and I would like to welcome you all to our next talk, which is Lasers in Space by Henrik Ehler. Here you go, Henrik.
Yeah? Okay. So, not that used to microphones. Yeah, thanks for the invitation. I haven't been here before, and it's I've been here a few hours now. It's quite a big experience. It really seems like an amazing place. I even tried this. I can't describe it, but yeah, maybe you get used to it. I don't know. So, I was invited to talk about one of my side projects. I work a little bit here and there on all sorts of different things. But one of my projects is about sending stuff into space on purpose. I have a small correction to the title because it's more like, it's not lasers in general, but my laser, our laser. I'm doing the project together with a company in Aalborg. It's not GomSpace, but something called Space Inventor. It was founded by one of the founders of GomSpace. And we're doing it together with ESA and it's not called Højteknologi Fund, it's called the Innovation Fund. So I will, and also if you have any questions during the presentation, just let me know and we can also take them afterwards. Just a small disclaimer, we are involved in a proposal for a new project where part of this system will be integrated into, and the deadline for a proposal has been postponed, meaning that I have had last night to cut out quite a bit of my presentation because there are just some things I can't discuss yet, not because it's like government secrets, in terms of IP rights. We have competitors, and well, so we're keeping our cards a little bit close on some of the things. But still, I mean, I have 40 slides, so it'll be fun, I hope. I just want to go a little bit back in time, just to know where, to let you know where I'm coming from and where the project is coming from. So we need to go back to the, let's make some suspense. The year that brought us the DAP, BB-8, burning hoverboards, and of course, Katy Perry's Left Shark. Of course, I'm talking about 2015. It's not that long ago. But it was a time where I was a little bit in between projects and jobs, and the aforementioned friend of mine who founded Space Inventors, he approached me because he wanted another popular word at that time was disruption, but he wanted to disrupt the small satellite industry. He also knew that I was involved in DTU set 2. That was like, at that time it was 10 years ago, so it's, I'm getting old, I guess. And I also apologize that I don't have higher resolution pictures than this, but the internet was just, 720p at that time, so it's the best I got. That project was about tracking birds. At my time on DTU, it never launched. I think it only launched like 5 years ago. But nevertheless, it was just a few courses I had at DTU, but it was my it was the starting point for this project because I knew a little bit about space technology, not much, but I've touched it. And as I said, we wanted to take a different approach to producing and designing microsatellites. It's been there are like two ways into this industry. There are the big competitors that make huge satellites, like governments and private entities, and then there are the universities. And it's two very different approaches. So our philosophy was to take the way the big companies did it and try to miniaturize some of these things. And this was 2015. About 7 months later, we attended a conference in Malta called the 4S Symposium. It's this small conference for companies that produce both complete satellites but also subsystems for these microsatellites. So you won't see any of the big companies, but all sorts of startups and independent young companies attend these symposiums. Of course, there's also a lot of talks like here, but in this case, we had our booth where we presented our products. Just take a sip. One of the things we did was to pack all our subsystems into individual smaller packages or encasings, which is again is the way the big boys do it. And we got thanks. It's not that bad actually. It's just new. Yeah. So anyway, we took this approach to design things to be very robust and small independent modules that could be stacked together. This meant that we could, from our Lego bricks, we could build a whole satellite in a matter of days from off-the-shelf items we've made, or not off-the-shelf, but independent systems we've made, compared to a normal microsatellite that would take like months just to put together. We got a lot of attention also from ESA. One of the products we presented was our LaserLink, or laser downlink terminal, as we call it. This was another almost coincidence, because besides my involvement with the DTU set, I spent quite a lot of time at the photonics department at DTU, so also knew a little bit about lasers. And just in a second, I will come to why we want lasers in space, but yeah, this little thing got a lot of attention, and it was just a prototype. We weren't really sure if it would work or how it would work. We also met people that have been trying to do this for plus 10 years, and they're like, how did you make it so small? And I was like, I didn't know what to say, because it's just a prototype. So now let's get into the reason for the product. So why do we, that was our backstory, but why would we want to put lasers into space? It can solve quite a big problem, a problem that that is relevant both for big and small satellites, but especially for small satellites. And it's a matter of communication. I guess you probably guessed that by now. But if we take a look at the traditional approach to data downlink from satellites, this is not to scale. The satellite is in fact quite a bit smaller than this. And there's no banana, but you know. But again, this is just a representation. So this satellite is in what's called low Earth orbit, which is about anywhere from 400 to 800 kilometers above sea level. The speed is between 7.5 to 9 kilometers per second, depending on the orbit. And that means the round time is roughly 100 minutes for rotation of the Earth. So this means that when you want to communicate with your satellite, this is completely different to geostationary satellites. Of course, they have a fixed position. That's a whole different story. But these low Earth orbit satellites, you only have a few minutes, maybe 2-3 times a day, where you can talk with your product or your project. Due to budget and frequency allocations, most small satellites they need to use the ISM bands, so yeah, anywhere from 400 megahertz to a few gigahertz. And the reason for this is that they, even though you try to make a very directional antenna, you'll usually cover a circle about 3,000 kilometers, even from this low altitude. Meaning that when you try to send data, you take up the frequency space for whole continents. And this means that you can't send with a very high power, which again means that you can't really send very much data. You can get a frequency allocation saying that you can use a specific frequency and send with a lot higher power, but it's very, very expensive because it covers so many countries whole continents. So it means that the effective data rate of these small satellites are in the kilobits range, which is fine for housekeeping data and just to get a beacon from your satellite. But one of the things that people really want to do is to take pictures, and it's not that difficult to put a nice camera on a satellite, even the small ones, the small satellites. But with this data rate, it takes days just to get a single image. And if you have like hyperspectral cameras or other scientific equipment that that produce even more data, it's you have a bottleneck there. So that's where our laser comes into play. First of all, the affected circle is, depending on the altitude, it's about 100 meter compared to 3,000 kilometers. So we only hit a very small area of the Earth, and just due to the nature of optical transmission, it's not picked up by all sorts of things and garage door openers and it means that we can achieve speeds even with these small systems easily 1 gigabit per second, but in theory with our current system 10 gigabits per second. That's including overhead for error corrections and so on. So that's sort of the backstory and why the product is relevant. I need to also say that this is not an original idea. NASA has been working on this for quite some time. This is just a render, but it's from a project called OPALS, which was tested on the ISS. Putting lasers into space is not new, but doing it at that small scale, that's also the hard part. But that's our core business. You could never fit this to a CubeSat. it's, I can't remember the exact size, but a few meters on each direction, as far as I remember. So, for those of you who are not don't know this, this is a 1U CubeSat. It's also called a U-class spacecraft. It was developed for use with especially universities to get a chance to send something into space without being part of a huge multi-billion project. So this 1 liter cube is the, it's like the minimal dimensions. I brought one. This is a 2U satellite. There's nothing in it. It's just the mechanics. But in principle, you can build these up to 24 units, not in length, but you can go in all three dimensions, so 2 by 2 by 2 or whatever you want. But it's a nice form factor, and it also means that many of the launch providers, they these are not sent up usually just as the primary payload, but they piggyback on different on bigger missions. So when a company paid for a launch of a communication satellite, there's also this gets stowed away in that glove box, so to speak. More precisely, it's in a small tube, and it'll get ejected into space after the satellite has been released from the launch vehicle. Another great things about this philosophy is to use a lot of what's called off-the-shelf, commercial off-the-shelf equipment, mean that you don't have to develop everything yourself. You can use, is my computer making the noise? Or? Oh, never mind. I just didn't know what was going on. But you can use off-the-shelf camera modules and so on, because it's not a critical thing. If it doesn't work, well, at least you learn something. Also the technology level, readiness level requirements for sending a CubeSat into space is a lot less than for a real spacecraft. Anyway, what did I write? So as of January this year, about 1,300 CubeSats are in orbit, or they have been launched. 1,200 successfully, and 90 has been destroyed in launch failures or are just not operational or was never operational. Since these are built by primarily students, mistakes happen. Both the first few CubeSats from Denmark wasn't functional, not for long as I remember. And this is a render of 1U CubeSat made with a Space Inventor. Regarding the price, these are quite inexpensive. A guy like this with solar panels and some payload will run you just about 200,000-300,000 euros. So it's affordable. So I'll go into a little bit details about the laser project. And some of the drawings I'll show you are of a little bit older date because, as I said, we ran into some issues last night regarding what we can show and what we can't. So this is way too small to see, right? Okay. So I have, let's see. Yeah, this is just a simplified diagram of the system. Now it's upside or on the side, but at least a little bit bigger. Just to show you the main components of the laser terminal. We have the OBC, which is an onboard computer. That's the square. Okay, I'll stand completely still. The, sc- square up here, it communicates with something called a space wire, which is a derivative of a firewire. No, it's not a joke, it's real. It sounds way cooler. I mean, firewire was already a cool name, but you know. And then we have the optical subsystem. It consists of a seed laser. We're running at 1064 nanometers, and the seed laser is what we modulate with our data signal. It goes into a fiber amplifier, which amplifies the signal from a few milliwatts to about 1 watt optical output power. It's not that much. You can get laser pointers, you shouldn't, but you can, that are way more powerful than this. But our beam is much nicer, I assure you that. And then we have some mechanics for fine steering, and I'll come back to why we need that. One of the big issues with a system like this is, remember, we only hit a 100 meter, well, not target, but our beam is just 100 meters from 400 to 600 kilometers away. So it's quite difficult to hit the right, hit the target. Small satellites like this one, when they're in orbit, they are not. They rotate like crazy. They are not. They're not stationary, and that's why we have something called an attitude control system. But even with a system like this, they are very, very unstable. We are talking things like plus minus a whole degree of movement. Which is fine for everything else, but almost trying to hit the Earth with a laser. So it's quite fine. Attitude control system consists of two major components, reaction wheels, which are, just imagine a skateboard wheel with a motor and you can spin it up. And we have this whole thing about a reaction and action and reaction mean that when you spin something in one direction, the whole spacecraft spins in the other direction. We have four of those, so we can orient or we can turn in all directions. And then we have something called magnetorquers. And that's because when these wheels, they hit a certain speed, they can't go any faster. So at certain intervals, we need to dump the energy in the wheels. So we lock with these magnetic with these coils, we can sort of lock onto the Earth's magnetic field, mean that we, by sending power to the coils, we can keep the spacecraft stationary while we spin down the wheels. And when we're done with that, we can start spinning up the wheels and getting into position again. That's also whole science. That's also a product for Space Inventor, so just let me know if you want to buy one. Anyway, with this system, we can get the pointing accuracy of about plus minus 1 degree, which is nowhere near good enough for our laser, but we are getting there. But that's not the only problem, because the spacecraft sort of knows where it is, but not precisely. When you launch a spacecraft, you'll get your the orbit parameters back from the launch providers, and you can kind of predict where the spacecraft will be at a given time, and you can relay this data to the spacecraft, and it will kind of know where to point the laser. But again, it's not precise enough, so we need a beacon from Earth, which we send into space. It could look like this, but it doesn't. It's just a small 5 watt laser, and it goes out of a telescope, so it's a quite big beam. So it's kind of boring actually. But we point the laser to the area in the sky where we expect the satellite to be, when we want to communicate with. We don't know exactly where it is, so on the first orbits we'll go in some special patterns, actually it's just circle going outwards, just in hopes to get a log on. Other people have tried this, they need to use multiple orbits just to get the first light hitting the satellite. So we are very not concerned, but yeah, let's see how it goes. And actually, we just to correct myself, we don't point at the satellite. We have some point ahead, so because there are a little bit of travel time, so we point to where we expect the spacecraft to be when the beam hits it. Just let's go back to this slide again. On the far top right, you can see that's the where the beacon laser hits the spacecraft. And it goes through some optics, and then the beacon laser is focused down to just to a commercial a machine vision camera. We use that to track the dot around on the chip, on this image, you probably can't see it, but the whole right box, at that time we designed this, we wanted to move both the receiver and all the optics. We changed that a little bit, so now we have some mirrors that will take care of all the pointing. But nevertheless, we received the beacon laser in this camera, and we didn't know how the satellite is aligned to the ground station on Earth. And just to stay in the whole realm of commercial products, this is our ground station. It's a big telescope. Well, it's 10 or 12 inches. So it's for the serious amateur, I guess. But it is off-the-shelf telescope. We modify it a bit, but that's the basis of our ground station. Now we'll get another drawing that you probably can see, but I did the same trick again, so I don't know if it's better, but this is the whole ground segment. We have the telescope that will both send out the beacon laser towards the spacecraft, but also receive that downlink laser. The laser goes into something called, sensitive photodiode, which we use to demodulate the signal. And then a whole lot of stuff going on, but again, it's built up around this commercial telescope and then just a small box. So, this now I'll just shortly cover the fine steering. That means the way we steer the beam from the spacecraft. And that's one of the areas where we run into quite some issues. This is a MEMS mirror. I don't know if you are familiar with MEMS devices, but they are in gyroscopes and all other things. And this is a perfect mirror for some applications, at least. Just to go back to this image again, the mirror replaces the whole right box. So it doesn't move the optics, it just moves the beam, just to, this is one of the areas where you need to remember that we are in space. The beam is just about 1 watt, the downlink beam. It's not that much. But due to the way that MEMS devices work, this small mirror, it's about 8 millimeters in diameter. It needs to have a very, very low mass. because these MEMS motors, at least not these types, are not very powerful. So, and we need to move it quite rapidly. It, not like we are scanning, but we need to keep up with different things. So, we have one watt laser hitting a very, very light mirror, and we don't have any air. So, this mirror is extremely shiny, or reflective, I should probably say. But there is a small loss, and this small loss is converted into heat, and the mass is almost nothing. So, if we try to do this, we will end up with a burning mirror very quickly. And now we go into the part of the presentation I can't go into, but we did solve this. I can tell you a bit about some of the things we tried and failed miserably. We tried to encase the mirror in a small box with a window in it and fill it with an atmosphere of helium, I think, can't remember. No, nitrogen, of course. Trying to make use of convection. And yeah, that wasn't a success. We also tried, you can get piezo actuators. They are very powerful. And they can easily move a big mirror and a heat sink and the whole desk. But the way they work, they only move like almost at the nanometer scale, meaning that, and they have a expected lifetime of a certain amount of millions of movements they can do. So if you try to use a product like this in our case, it will stop, it will be at the end of life in about 15 minutes because it's sort of a technology that's used for more stationary objects. So, yeah, a little bit about the future. We hope to fly this prototype next year. We have passed something called a critical design review actually last year. Then due to COVID and other stuff, we've not been working that much as of lately, but now it's picking up again. We have some, we're working right now on the flight model. So now we have everything lined up at a breadboard level, both the electronics and the optical systems. And now we're integrating the whole, this square meter of stuff into a small box. With some luck, this work will be done around Christmas. And then if we pass all the reviews and tests, then we just have to wait for a launch opportunity. It could be with a rocket, it could also be tossed out of the window of the ISS. It's up to ESA to give us this opportunity. So. Yeah, and this was about 10 minutes less than expected, but as again, I'm sorry I couldn't tell you much about everything. But if there's any questions, let me know.
Any questions? Yeah, we can start up here.
How do you deal with atmospheric refractions? Because you don't have a kind of reference laser that tells you about the state of the atmosphere to compensate for that?
Disturbances?
Yeah.
So we for the first tests and so on, we are going to see how it goes. but you can do like they do in the big telescopes with adaptive optics and having a laser pointing towards the sky and measuring the disturbances. So. It will probably be needed in a commercial setting. We chose 1064 nanometers. We could also use 1550 like you use in telecom. Both of those frequencies are almost not dampened by the atmosphere. It will still be disturbed, but there's not much absorption.
You told us there's a like a 100-meter spot, and you have following and tracking. But what's the window of time you can communicate before you get out of reach? Because there's a 7.5 kilometer per second going by.
It depends on the orbit. Also, so if we're standing here and the satellite goes above us, it can be way out in the horizon, and we only have a very limited time, or it can go right above us. And also depends on the on the height of the orbit, but we've designed the system to get about 4 or 5 minutes window. If we get very low into the horizon, even though as it's 1064 nanometers, doesn't get absorbed that well or that much by the atmosphere. Just like when you have the sunset, when the light has to go through a lot more air, it gets dampened a lot more. So,
okay, thank you.
Just a few minutes.
Any more questions? No? Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.